You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
We're going to convene this this panel. My name is Dan Blumenthal, and I'm Kurt's friend from AEI. I think we have a very interesting panel today. I read in quite with a lot of interest and a lot of depth. My panelists' papers, which are I think very meaty and very interesting. I won't go into their biographies because I think you have them in front of you. And in the interest of time, we're going to try to cover a lot of ground. So I think what we'll do is you have the PowerPoint up, so I think we're going to start with you. Okay, and we'll have you speak for about 10 minutes. Can you do that? And then we'll move to path afterwards for about 10 minutes, and then I'll have some comments on your presentations as well. Okay.
Thank you, Chairman. Good morning, ladies, gentlemen, friends. It's my great honor to make a presentation at this very important conference. Now, the world situation has entered a new phase. Now, not only China is rising, but also a number of developing countries have been, including India, have been rising. The whole Asia is rising. And also, the center of international economics and politics have begun to move, to transfer from Atlantic area to the Asia-Pacific region. The center of the issues of the world or in Asia is that developed countries, including the United States, the United States and other developed countries accept, tolerate, and even encourage China and other rising powers to play a more active role in or a responsible role in the international system and regional mechanisms. On the other hand, can China and other rising powers accept, engage, and positively participated in the international system and regional mechanism? So it will be a very long process during which there will be a lot of cooperation, competition, and games, playing between developed countries and developing countries and among developing countries. China is in a dilemma now. I think China now is in the process of learning how to become a responsible power in the international system and the regional mechanism. And I think China would like to become a responsible power in international system. However, now China in a dilemma. On one hand, if China plays a much bigger role in some issues. Other countries now are concerned about the China threat. On the other hand, if China did not do something as to some issues, other countries also criticize China as a free rider or something like that. So it's quite difficult for China. Historically, the dominant power in the international system usually exploits contradictions between two rising powers to check them. However, this is the era of globalization. Rising powers today, China and India, and the dominant power in the international system, the United States, share more and more common interests and face more and more challenges. They have to cooperate in many fields while also competing with each other on many issues. It is better for them to engage in positive competition and do their best to realize results in which everyone wins. Traditionally, continental powers, China and India, are now evolving as maritime powers as well. China historically has shown more interest in the Pacific Ocean, though the Indian Ocean is drawing more of its attention because it serves as one of China's important sea lines of communication. India, meanwhile, has historically exhibited more interest in the Indian Ocean, but now has increasing interest in the Pacific Ocean. To a large extent, how the two countries deal with each other and with the United States, the global maritime power, will decide the future of Asian security. Beyond the China-Indian maritime interests, there are some other flash points in Asia. To China, the three most pressing security concerns confronting Asia are now the Diaoyu Islands. Now, I think different now is for China, as I wrote the chapter. Now, the second is Korean Peninsula. The third is South China Sea. And also, China is concerned about the Iranian nuclear issue. So, as the South China Sea, I think now because Nansha Islands and the Xisa Islands in South China Sea have been China's territories for more than 1,000 years. I think now United States rebalancing policy or pivot to Asia send the wrong signals to some of its islands like Philippines. So the Philippines pursues carry out the tough policy towards China, which lead to some problems. So I think the United States should be quite should be not send the wrong signals to some countries in South China Sea. And also I think it's now as to the Diaoyu Islands. Diaoyu Islands has been China's territory since Ming Dynasty, since 17th century. And not because Japan nationalized the Diaoyu Islands last year, the China has to give very strong response. I think now the United States also send the wrong signals to Japan. Although the United States said it will not take sides over territory disputes between China and Japan. However, the U.S.-Japan military islands now applied to the Diaoyu Islands. So Japan also pursue the tough policy towards China as to the Diaoyu Islands. Now, the rightists in Japan now has been rising, so it's quite dangerous. Because in 1920s and the 1930s, after the big earthquake in Tokyo and also the economic recession in 1930s, Japan became the resource, the source of aggression war in Asia. Now, similarly, now after the earthquake, big earthquake in Japan, and also the international financial crisis, now in Japan, the rightists now has quite now is popular. So it's very dangerous. So as to Diaoyu Islands, I think I don't think China will do anything provocative. However, if Japan continue to have something provocative, China will have very strong response. If Japan send some administrative personnel to Diaoyu Islands, China will also send administrative personnel to Diaoyu Islands. If Japan send armed forces or something to Diaoyu Islands, China, I think, will also give a very strong response to that. However, I think the territory and also sovereignty are very, very important. However, they are not the most important issue. The most important issue is people's welfare and the social development. The European countries put forward the concept of sovereignty first. However, it took hundreds of years, including experiencing two world war. The European countries realized the truth. So since the end of the Second World War, the European countries has gone along the road of regional cooperation and regional integration. And Asia is very different from Europe. Asian countries realize independence very late. So Asian countries pay very importance on sovereignty and territory. However, I think the Asian countries also should go towards the regional integration and to realize the Asian community and Asia-Pacific community. I think China and the United States now the core national interests of them are not conflicting because the United States the core national interests of the United States is to maintain its leadership in the world. The China's core national interests is to realize the modernization by 2050. And also the two countries share more and more common interests. So the two countries should make great efforts to reduce the strategic distrust and to have more cooperation. Because the time is limited, I stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much also for being so concise. And over to Srikanth.
Thank you, Dan. Good afternoon to you all. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you on this regional order and the U.S.-China-India relations broadly. What I will do is quickly, telegraphically report to you on the four major issues. One, in terms of the regional order. Second, in terms of the challenges that the regional order is facing. What are the efforts that India made in this context? And what is the U.S. role? How do India visualize this, the United States' role in this context, in the regional security context? The good news is, of course, the regional order, as the previous speaker had mentioned, there's been higher economic growth rates in Asia. We have China maintaining during the financial crisis and the Eurozone crisis time nearly 6 to 7% growth rate last year, and India maintaining 5.9% growth rate in the economic. Indonesia, Vietnam, and other countries as well are rising in terms of the GDP figures, gross domestic product figures. Secondly, in terms of the middle class emergence, we have seen China reporting over 150 million people in this category, while India has 300 million middle class, which is the basis for consumption patterns, which is another trend. The consumption patterns in Asia are also increasing in terms of the goods and services, but it is nowhere near to the transatlantic world in terms of the combined GDPs or combined consumption patterns in this area. Nevertheless, we see this transition taking place in the Asian context. Second is the major challenges that are facing the regional security, especially in terms of the commons, global commons, cybersecurity, maritime security, and in terms of the various issues. What are the challenges that overall India faces? Number one, sovereignty and territorial integrity issues. As the previous session had highlighted, India's concerns on the sovereignty and territorial integrity issues, specifically related to Pakistan and China. China, last 3 years, has been asserting in terms of the Kashmir as well as the Arunachal Pradesh related issues. From 2005-06, Chinese official documents configure this area as part of the southern Tibet, Arunachal Pradesh as part of the southern Tibet. We have also seen the former Chinese ambassador to India, Mr. Sun Yuexi, mentioning the whole of Arunachal Pradesh as a disputed territory, leading to tensions in the India-China context. Specifically from 2009, we have also seen that China had taken a very active position on the Kashmir-related issues. In specifically three major parts. One is in terms of considering the Pakistan-controlled Kashmir areas as not disputed, while the Indian-controlled areas as disputed, which basically meant that the Chinese will have a free ride in the Pakistan-controlled Kashmir areas, specifically in terms of investments and which are dual-use in nature with true presence, as Sally Harrison had written in August 2009, about 7,000 to 11,000 troops, which the Chinese have denied, yet that is a major concern. Second, in terms of the Kashmir initiative, China is contemplating, or some of the NGOs in China have been inviting the Hurriyat leaders, and according to some Chinese reports, to create a government in exile for Kashmir in the lines of the government in exile that Tibet had witnessed in the last five decades. If that does happen, then we could possibly see India-China tensions mounting. Fortunately, for the last year or so, there's been, with the communication from India to China, and during Premier Wen Jiabao's visit in December 2010, there have been a scaling down on the Kashmir issue. In other words, what India is trying to communicate is for reiterating the One China policy, India is suggesting to China of a quid pro quo, a reciprocity of One India policy in the Kashmir and the Arunachal Pradesh context, and that is now being contested between the two sides. The second major challenge that India faces is obviously on terrorism, and the third main challenge is on economic development aspects. As you know, that the Prime Minister Manmohan Singh had announced an increase in the manufacturing sector capacity from the current 14% to that of about 29% of the GDP. Secondly, in terms of attracting over $1 trillion in the infrastructure development projects. And when India looked at which are the countries which could provide for the infrastructure development capacities, it found Japan, Taiwan, Singapore, and European Union as contributing to the infrastructure development in India. We have also seen the U.S. initiatives in this regard on setting up roads, railways, airfields, shipbuilding capacities, and so on and so forth. That is what India is looking at. However, in terms of the Eurozone crisis and the IMF diverting resources for the PICS countries, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, and so on, India does find that the credit availability becomes a problematic for the infrastructure development in India, and hence this is part of that BRICS bandwagon, where India is trying to suggest that the credit availability should be made to the developing countries. India has also been able to make efforts in terms of the FTA and SEPA agreements, Comprehensive Economic Partnership agreements. While it is lukewarm to any FTA proposals from China because of the concerns of the Mumbai Club that China will be able to take advantage of the Indian economy and has implications for the strategic autonomy of India. And hence, I think India had opened up more for Japan, for South Korea, for Singapore, the ASEAN FTA, and now negotiating with the European Union for the FTA. And a couple of days ago, Ashley Tellis in his report had suggested to US-India FTA proposal, which is what India is also looking at in terms of expanding its economic capacities. As you all know, that in terms of the GDP, the service sector is higher in component than compared with the manufacturing sector. This is what India is trying to bridge the gap, because the manufacturing sector would provide for more jobs in India, and hence that is the major concern in India. Thirdly, in terms of what India had done to ameliorate these challenges, number one, in terms of entering into bilateral or multilateral relations, the Congress Party, which is the major component of the UPA too, had configured in its manifesto that relations with the United States, Russia, European Union, Japan, and China, in that order of preference, will be the emphasis of the UPA government. And it had done several initiatives to enhance these bilateral relations. There is also the Lucky's policy, which is now bearing fruits. Secretary Clinton had argued for, instead of a Lucky's, India should act East in terms of pitching its forces for the counter piracy and a host of other non-traditional security issues that are coming up in the Asia-Pacific region. Indeed, India had committed over 20,000 sailors for overcoming the tsunami disaster in 2004-05 and evacuating roughly about 26,000 victims from Thailand, Indonesia, and other places. There is also the Indian Defense Minister's offer at the Shangri-La Dialogue on counter-piracy operations in the South China Sea and in the vicinity, as well as in the Indian Ocean region. India had also committed its hard power for cyclone disaster and natural disaster relief measures, such as during the cyclone Nargis in Myanmar, where the Indian Air Force was the only force which was allowed to go into Myanmar some years ago. And also in Sichuan earthquake in May 2008, when seven sorties of the Indian Air Force transports went in to supply tents and other required materials. Additionally, the Indian component in the UN PKO is quite substantial. Over 100,000 troops have been committed so far, and currently about 9,000 troops are in different places of the world. Finally, in terms of the other Indian efforts, CBMs is one major area of concern and initiative. The Pakistan-India nuclear CBMs are going well. Every year they report to each other in terms of the military installations, nuclear military installations, and so on and so forth. Although CBMs with China are at the conventional level, and following the 1172 resolution in the United Nations Security Council, China is reluctant to initiate any CBMs in the nuclear field and does not recognize India's nuclear potential or capability, unlike the United States 123 agreement, which considers India as a responsible country. Finally, in terms of the U.S. role, India sees U.S. as inclusive to Asia and provides for stability for the global commons in the maritime, cyber, and space domains. India sees U.S. In a positive manner in these initiatives. And in fact, as Ashton Carter had mentioned, the defense relations between U.S. and India had substantially increased. In fact, defense ties are becoming the basis for the bilateral relations, as he said during a visit to India. Substantially, over $18 billion of deals are to be concluded, of which nearly $8 billion have already been concluded. We also have over 50 exchanges between the two sides in the defense field. There is the 17-odd dialogue processes in different areas, economy, agriculture, space, military, and a host of other issues. There is however, there is the Indian concern that while United States is a major game changer in the international system, as reflected in Nixon Kissinger's visit to China in 1972, or Condoleezza Rice's statement in Sofia University in 2005, February, about India, it could also be a wild card in terms of the proposals that came during the Obama I administration when we had the G2, Brzezinski's idea of G2. This is in the backdrop of these vagaries in the U.S. administration. India emphasizes on strategic autonomy and a certain distance from the United States because we are entering into uncharted transitions in this sphere. Thank you very much.
Thank you both. I'm going to offer a few comments before we open it up to questions. I will say that Kirk Campbell used the my children are sick card to elicit sympathy from the audience and lower expectations and so forth. And I'm going to do the same exact thing shamelessly. My children aren't sick, but I'm temporarily, I hope, my wife comes back tonight, the single father of three, and they spilled all kinds of things on me. And if I look more flustered than usual, that's my excuse. So with that in mind, let me move to some commentary. I was specifically asked by Ashley to look at how the U.S. is interacting and viewing the emerging Asian order. And there was this mention in commentary before in the last panel about I think conventional wisdom that the United States has a short historical memory, which I don't necessarily agree with, actually. And I think that a lot of Asian policy and Asian strategy for the United States goes back to its experiences in World War II. And so the biggest and that terrible, terrible war and the terrible slog through the Pacific and the desire among military officers and statesmen after the war to never have to repeat that again. So in the first instance, the U.S. and Asian order is meant to prevent the domination of Asia by any power or collection of power that might become hostile again and might present a threat to U.S. territory. And of course, we've been through that experience before and don't want to see it again. That's in the first instance. In the second instance, I think that which is derivative in some ways of the first, or at least complements the first, is that we're going to maintain a forward presence based on our alliances, not because at the time we saw any particular threat emerging, although we obviously saw the Soviets emerging somewhat in East Asia or communist China at the time, but because, again, we were going to deploy as far forward as possible because we have sovereign territory inside the Pacific. So, again, I think that it was very much seared into the minds and still is seared into the minds of policymakers and military planners. I think the third lesson that we learned and therefore put a policy in place to not repeat the mistakes of the past is to build as open an international economic system as was possible and to include as many participants in that system as we could because part of the lessons of World War II, what happens when a country decides to become autarkic and self-reliant on energy and so on and so forth. So we were willing and able at the time to not just set up an open and liberal trading regime, but actually to do so on an asymmetric basis, meaning that we were prepared to run great deficits, trade deficits, so that Asian economies could essentially use an export-led growth model. Whether or not we're still willing to do that as a nation is coming into some serious question. But that was part of at the grand strategy level. That was a deliberate policy. So the Asian order, I think, for the United States. The policy in helping to create and being the prime player in the Asian order worked out well for the United States, all told, up to this point. Of course, there were some very bloody wars in the middle inside Asia, but it's very important to note that there has not been a great power war in Asia since the end of the Vietnam War, since the end of the Sino-Vietnam War in 1979. And that is something that nobody predicted. Nobody predicted in 1979 and 1980. So in general, I think that the policy and the strategy has been successful. There are ups and downs, of course, but generally in terms of maintaining great power peace, in terms of maintaining our own forward security, in terms of encouraging as many emerging states to join the liberal economic order, and so on, I think the policy is something that the U.S. is generally happy about. But history doesn't stop, and it would be great if we could say, job well done, let's go home. China and India, to take the point of the commentary beforehand, are re-rising, and so the United States had a dilemma and a choice about what to do about nations that are re-rising as great powers who could put some serious strain on U.S. view of order and U.S. view of security. And of course, we've had two different strategies because the countries are so different. So in the case of India, fellow liberal democracy, which makes a great difference in throughout United States history to how we perceive countries, rightly or wrongly, But the transparency of India, there's no, both in intent and in terms of military investments and deployments, there's nothing we're particularly concerned about with respect to India. In fact, we went so far as to say that we want India to emerge as a great power and play a greater role and build it up and so forth. And I think in Srikanth's paper, It's well to remember, as he points out, that that India is still, as much as we want it to act east and look east, India is still beset by major border tensions and border problems, and so and terrorism and I think if depending on what happens in Afghanistan, there'll be a whole new set of problems. So our ability to encourage India to play a greater role in maintaining a favorable balance of power in the East Asian order, I think, will be conditioned upon India's own surroundings and its own great challenges with respect to its borders and so on. I think the way we approached China and are continuing to approach China was well described by Assistant Secretary Campbell. It's more complicated. It's more complicated in that since 1972, maybe even certainly since the Nixon and Kissinger opening, and consistently we've wanted to welcome China into the order that we created and we shed blood and treasure for, or more so than other countries. And we've been doing so on a level of multi-dimensional engagement since that time. But in the later, as the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union began to collapse, which was one of the great motivations to start this process, we certainly saw Chinese security strategies and security capabilities that started to cause us concern. Every nation, of course, is entitled to build a military, and no one should comment on the sovereign right of every country to build a military. I think it's the nature of that military that's both opaque and destabilizing, rather than a military buildup that is one that is looking to protect and provide for the common welfare and public goods and so on and so forth. That's something we don't see with India. I think the other concerns that both Srikanth and others mentioned in their paper is just the opacity and the unpredictability of China, in the sense of saying that sovereignty is sacrosanct, and I certainly understand Chinese dilemmas when it comes to this point, because the United States for so long was saying accept the norms of the post-World War II system, and then we in Europe went ahead and changed the world, changed the World War II system of sovereignty being sacrosanct from 1992 until today with our various interventions for humanitarian affairs and other places. So I can certainly see where China's kind of going, what are you talking about? You're changing the rules of the game your own. But the point I'm trying to make is reunification, sovereignty, the South China Sea being Chinese property, the kinds of things that Dr. Xia mentioned himself, they're not so well defined. And I think Srikanth brings them up quite a bit in the sense of what does southern Tibet actually mean? Where does the border end and where does it begin? And obviously now India has to focus a lot of military time and effort on that question. What does it mean to have to say that the South China Sea is China's property? Where does that end and where does that begin? And who's allowed to use that property? What does it mean to say that China's, which Xia very candidly, and I appreciate the candor, pointed out in his paper, what does it mean to say that the Dayutai Senkakus are Chinese property, and particularly when these are contested? So where exactly are those borders drawn? And sometimes these claims come out, seemingly from an American point of view out of nowhere, or they're not timed in ways that we can really fully understand. So I think there's that element of unpredictability about what China demands as its main principles are in terms of the sacrosanct, how sacrosanct sovereignty is, and how much that conflicts with others' definitions of their own sovereignty. And that will be a major issue going forward in whether or not we can continue to establish this Asian order that has done so well, not just for the United States, the prime player, but also for all the other countries involved, I think. And finally, I'll end on two notes. So the first note is that India is clearly, as are many other countries, watching very carefully what the United States is doing in the sense of the sustainability, as Kurt Campbell mentioned, of our policy in the Asia Pacific, and that means that they're watching our debates here about our budget, our fiscal situation, and so on and so forth. And so they are hedging. I think a lot of countries are hedging not just against China and outcomes there, but also against the U.S. ability, the U.S. political will, the U.S. wherewithal, to actually sustain a policy, such a robust policy of this nature. The second point I'd end on is this very important question, which wasn't mentioned too much in the papers, of the nuclear question, and what that means for the United States in terms of its own arms reductions treaties, particularly with Russia, but what that means now when you have all kinds of incentives, and I can't prove unless one of my Chinese friends wants to tell me what the actual numbers are of Chinese warheads and so on. I can't prove that they're growing, but I will say the incentive structure we've put in place right now is such that if I was Chinese, I would consider growing my arsenal because we talk very openly about conventional strike against the mainland in terms of our military strategy. We're going down in numbers, all kinds of reasons. And, of course, the Indian-China balance, which is both nuclear powers, both with ballistic missiles. So, I would leave that out there as a kind of looming issue over all these other questions of Asia's security order. It took a long time to learn and to manage that competition with the Soviets. I think U.S., India, Japan, China, in terms of getting some real clarity on strategic nuclear issues is going to be increasingly important. So I'll end there and open it up to questions. And in the back there, you. Yes, with a yellow tie. Yeah.
Good morning. I'm Mr. Lloyd from the Philippine Daily Inquirer. And since we are talking of regional security, I have a question for the first speaker. Why is it that it is only now that China is showing its military might to the neighboring Asian countries, especially the smaller countries like Vietnam and the Philippines, especially in the claims of islands, whatever name you name it, in the South China Sea? Why is it that China was not bullying the smaller countries in the Asian region in the 70s and 80s and 90s? Is that because China was not yet an economic power back then? Or is that because that the Americans are still in Subic Naval Base and Clark Air Base, and the Soviets are still in Cameron Bay? Okay, why is it that you're only doing it now?
I understand the question.
Thank you.
Why is China bullying its neighbors? An easy question.
Since the 1980s, China has improved its relations with ASEAN countries, with Southeast Asian countries. The bilateral relations between China and ASEAN countries have been greatly developed in economic field. And now China is one of the biggest trade partners with those countries. And also China supports the leading role of ASEAN in regional mechanism. However, I understand that because China is a big country, now is developing very quickly, so other the neighboring countries, especially middle countries and small countries, are quite a concern. Now there are the double interdependence in this area in economic field. China and its neighboring countries now economic interdependence have been
developing very quickly. On the other hand, in security field, those countries would like to have the United States to have a balance of China. So as the South China Sea, I don't think China asked the whole South China Sea because according to the UN and UNCLOS, the islands China and islands can if China now insist the islands of Nansha and Xisha are territories of China. The islands can have the territory sea and of also the EEZ and the reefs. can have the 12 miles of territory sea. So other areas, I think, are high sea and also other. I think the free navigation is in China's national interest because China now is one of the biggest trade of country. I think now China would like to have good relations with its neighboring countries. And also, I think in the future, China would make efforts to improve its relations with its neighboring countries. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to remind everyone, both questioners and answerers, that we are what sits between this panel and lunch. So let's try to be as succinct as possible. Let me take two, actually. So over here, you, sir, and over there, right after that.
Yes, Bill Jones from Executive Intelligence Review. I have a question, Mr. Kondapalli, regard to how the Indians are viewing this issue of national sovereignty. Ashley indicated that some people like China or some countries like China adhere to the Westphalian idea of sovereignty, whereas India is changing its position. However, the debate that's going on at the UN, which would really kind of transform it entirely, this right to govern policy, where if a Security Council decision is taken that a country is not, you know, governing correctly, intervention could be called for. I would think that also India has a lot of concerns about the direction that's going. I'll take the example of Syria. Of course, Russia and China, part of their reason for trying to negotiate an agreement in Syria is that they do not agree with this idea of this humanitarian interventionism or interventionism of that sort. India has been very quiet on that, but I would think that also there are some concerns there that doctrine, which has served them so well, is also something they don't want to see down the tubes. And I was wondering if you could say something about that and India's relation to that.
Thank you. I'm Kadir Amiria, a member of the governing board of South Asian University, which is built under the SAARC. And in the meantime, I want to take this opportunity to thank you, the Sang JNU, for accommodating this new university in their campus until they build their infrastructure. My question related to this topic, today's one, is the position of India vis-a-vis this current negotiations, as you may know, in Washington, is ongoing one between President Karzai, President Obama, and certainly some other members, participants in this dialogue. And what would be the position of India vis-a-vis these negotiations, current negotiations, if I may ask this question?
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor.
Srikanth, I think both are for you. So.
Thank you very much for these excellent questions. On the first, I would argue on the contrary. I would refer you to former Foreign Minister S.M. Krishna's statement soon after the Tahrir Square incidents and Libyan and Syrian developments. It's a nuanced position, I agree, but most forthcoming was we support the popular uprisings in these states as part of the Arab Spring events. On the issues of regime change and the consequent disturbances in these countries, as we saw in Libya, as we saw in Egypt, and currently in Syria, one of the factors that is overweighing Indian considerations is we have over 6 million expatriates in this region who contribute substantially for the southern state Kerala's real estate and economic development through their contributions to back home. Secondly, in terms of the energy imports from this region, it's quite substantial. As you know, that India imports something like 85% of its energy from this region, over 24% from Iran, but as part of the Secretary Clinton's plan, we have reduced that to about 14%. Further, it is to be reduced with alternative energy plants, energy sources. But overall, apart from the security of the 6 million Indians who are living in this region, there is also the issue of energy. And so I think the nuanced position is because of these two reasons. Although we are diversifying the energy, and it does take time to diversify your energy basket from different states, and I think we are making efforts. The 6 million Indians are also important because soon after the Libyan no-fly zone, as well as the skirmishes, we have to evacuate several thousands of people from that region, and hence it imposed a huge logistics problem on India. And I think while India had suggested that it supports the mass uprising as part of the Arab Spring, it does have reservations on the regime change aspects, especially in terms of the destabilizing, any destabilizing trend that it could have in terms of the regime change. On the second issue on Afghanistan, India is one of the largest contributors for the Afghan reconstruction. The Indo-Tibetan Border Police had 2 battalions and is increasing its strength for the transportation networks in Afghanistan in terms of the road construction activity. Thirdly, in terms of the law and order training for the police, there is a huge investment there from India. There is also about 1,000 Afghan students are studying in India on different scholarships. There is, thirdly, in terms of the iron ore, copper, and other materials, there has been an initiative for exploitation of these resources. The Indian idea is obviously taking into consideration the Pakistani sensitivities that India is entering through a backdoor on the Afghan issue, and hence I think we are treading a very cautious line on that, and this is also probably in the U.S. interest before, but I think 2014 we will probably see more Indian role. But here I think there will be a larger convergence of interest between China, India, Russia, Iran, because we are going to face the flag if there is any increase in the al-Qaeda efforts post-2014.
I'm going to try for a symmetrical strategy. Very short question. If you think you could do it, very short answer. Okay? You've been waiting for a long time.
Thank you. Jin Ning Nguyen, Good Voice of Vietnamese Americans. Come back to the Asia security. I'd like to talk to Dr. Xie that since 1972, after the Shanghai Communique, China has repeatedly been invading Vietnam in 74, 78, 88, 79, and recently 2009 to 2010, 2012. And last week, they sent ship over and harassed Vietnamese fishermen. So that's not stabilized. Now, I'd like to ask both three panelists from India, from China, and from the U.S., what is one important factor that you can both converge in to help the South China Sea to stay peaceful and each country maintain its peace and sovereignty and developing economically? I'm talking about the COC that is now on the table of ASEAN.
Okay, I'll let Dr. Shao, why do you keep invading Vietnam? No, I'm kidding. Yeah, I do want to note, and I want to thank my Chinese friends. We've really come a long way. It's very difficult to be in this position, obviously, where there's a lot of concerns and critiques of China. And we've come a long way in terms of Chinese scholarship and candor on these issues. So I do want to thank you for being in the hot seat. And I'm being flippant. And then we'll go around real quickly on the last point.
Thank you for your question. China and Yunnan, I think we are neighbors, and also China play a very positive role in helping Yunnan to realize reunification in 1960s and early 1970s. And there was the border disputes between the countries, and also there are disputes over the Nansha Islands and also Xisa Islands. I think the Yunnan sometimes I think do something for Chinese people that is the provocative, and also the China ask of I think China and Yunnan and the Philippines signed the agreement about the joint exploration in the Nansha Islands about oil. However, the both Yunnan and the Philippines refuse to carry out the agreement. That is the cause quite the Chinese people now is very concerned about that. So there is also some disputes now. Yunnan also sometimes catch some Chinese fishermen, and also there are some disputes. However, I think during recent years, the both countries also make great efforts to have more cooperation, like the joint the patrol of navy vessels in this area. I think the both countries should make great efforts to have negotiations to resolve the problem. As the code of conduct in South China Sea, I think the China's attitudes towards the COC is quite positive. And however, the ASEAN should have negotiations with China about the COC during the COC the formation of the COC instead of now ASEAN put a draft and ask China to sign that is unfair. I think the China and ASEAN countries should have negotiations in detail about the draft of COC. Thank you.
Do you have anything to add?
Let me explain. In the Indian perception, Vietnam is a friend of India. We have, for example, when Deng Xiaoping was making that statement from the White House lawns in 1979 about teaching a lesson to Vietnam, and later when Vajpayee, the then foreign minister, was visiting China, he canceled that visit when the Sino-Vietnamese War took place. To indicate to the friendship. Of course, we have not been able to substantially enhance the military cooperation and so on. But Indian position on this issue is similar to that of the United States position. Free navigation, not involving in any territorial dispute between A and B in South China Sea. That's partly because over currently 55% of the Indian trade is passing through this region. And so any disruption in trade is detrimental to the Indian trade interests, and hence I think the free navigation principle has been stressed.
I want to thank everybody very much, and Xia and my Chinese friends in particular. Like I said before, I don't think we'd be having these candid conversations 10 years ago. I'll say welcome to the Big Power Club, because usually it's America that goes into another country or an American that goes into another country and gets criticized by. So welcome to the club, and expect a lot more of it. Thank you very much, and we convene for lunch.